Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning again, everyone. This is the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Ilya Meritz. Brian is off today. When the 116th Congress is sworn in just about 6 weeks' time, many Americans expect the subpoenas to start going out, well, pretty much immediately. There is big anticipation for this Congress, and specifically for the Democratic-controlled House, to start doing the oversight of the Trump administration that has been sorely lacking over the past 2 years of Republican control. There are probably more things to investigate than committees to do the investigating. Russian interference in the 2016 election, Trump Organization finances, scandals at the agencies, questions about the finances of cabinet members like Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, possible favors for Trump friends, and on and on and on, and, oh yeah, also Donald Trump's tax returns. So among all of this, how do you prioritize and how will we, the citizens, know if our Congress is doing a good job of oversight? We're going to talk now with someone who has experience actually doing congressional investigations. For many years, Elise Bean was a top aide to Michigan Senator Carl Levin, a Democrat, who served on the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. While she was there, Bean authored or contributed to reports on international money laundering, corporate tax avoidance, and all manner of financial frauds. She's also the author of a new book. Really, it's an investigator's memoir called Financial Exposure from Palgrave Macmillan. Elise, you've been a source for me in the past, and I'm so excited that you're here with me on the Brian Lehrer Show. Congratulations on the book. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. What are your questions about the next Congress's investigations? And let me put in a special plug for citizen journalists. This is your chance to talk with one of the best money trail sleuths out there and ask her advice. So give us a call. The number is 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Elise Bean, right after the election, one of the members of Congress, Richard Neal, Democrat of Massachusetts, likely next head of the Ways and Means Committee, said he is, in fact, preparing to request Donald Trump's tax returns. What do you think we could learn from them?
Well, one thing is important to understand that for Congress to get his tax returns, they have to be carrying out a legislative function, such as addressing a policy problem by enacting legislation or evaluating spending, something like that.
So they can't just demand them because they want them.
Well, the Supreme Court has specifically ruled that Congress cannot do an investigation simply to embarrass someone. That's just not a legal basis for a congressional investigation. So if they're going to seek the president's returns, the committee needs to be clear about its purpose. Now, it could be looking at it to examine conflicts of interest, for example, making policy decisions based on his businesses rather than in the public interest, whether there's evidence of tax evasion, for example. So there are purposes to look at that and see whether the law needs to be strengthened or reformed, but they have to be clear about that. There is a statute that's been in place since the 1920s about how Congress can get access to tax returns from the IRS. It's 6103F for those who want to look it up. And essentially, it says that there are three committees in Congress that can demand tax returns directly from the IRS, and that's Finance, Ways and Means, and the Joint Committee on Tax, so a Senate committee, a House committee, and a Joint Committee. Other committees could also get tax returns, but they'd have to get either the permission of one of those three committees or a resolution passed by the House or Senate. But what the statute doesn't talk about is that even if you get those returns, can you make them public? The only times in the past where committees have made tax returns public have been cases where the taxpayer gave their consent.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, you know, if you're an investigator, you don't really need to make the returns themselves public, which may have a lot of personal information. You could just summarize the information that's in those returns and make that information public.
So what would your advice be to House Democrats who really, really want this document? Should they come up with a really good reason to get it?
Yes, they need to be clear about why they want it and what they're going to be looking for. And, you know, there are a number of different ways to approach it. It's not like they're going to have a tough time finding out or figuring out what their justification should be, but it can't be to simply embarrass the president.
Now, so you worked on the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations from 1999 through 2014. That is, that's a very long time. And while you were there with Senator Levin, you sort of distilled, I guess, his principles for doing an investigation that has real impact. Some of them seem sort of obvious. Listen to all sides. Take your time. Take on tough guys. But one of the most important ones that you go into a lot of detail in your book is be relentlessly bipartisan. And I think that's such an interesting idea with Democrats about to take control of the House, because that is sort of not really the tone that I've been hearing about the possible investigations that could happen. Do you think it's possible to do a relentlessly bipartisan investigation of the Trump administration? Some of the stuff that is crying out for oversight?
Yes, is the short answer. Congress does bipartisan investigations all the time. They don't get covered by the press. Press often thinks they're boring because there's no fighting going on, but they actually are taking place all the time. You can think of investigations in this last Congress into opioids, into drug price gouging. There's a lot of things that both sides are concerned about that actually motivate these bipartisan investigations. The reason why bipartisanship is important, there's both practical and more sort of philosophical reasons. The practical reason is that when you make a request from both sides of the aisle, whoever gets that request is going to have a much harder time opposing it, saying that it's just a witch hunt or some, you know, all these other phrases we hear when it's both sides making the request. In addition, you know, I found over all of my years of investigating that when you investigate with people who have different viewpoints than your own, they notice different problems, different facts. They understand things differently, have different explanations for them. And if you're able to reach agreement on the facts with somebody you disagree with, you're much more likely to have a more thoughtful, thorough, and accurate fact-finding. And then when you're done with it, it's a lot more credible. So bipartisanship, and people who work in Congress, you know, they've seen what happens when you have partisan hearings, sort of partisan food fights. Nobody gives them much credibility. You don't really accomplish reforms. And in fact, you lower public opinion of Congress. And even the laws that you were able to pass on the one side, the Affordable Care Act, because no Republicans bought in, it's been under attack. Now you have the Republican tax law. Because no Democrat supported it, it's under attack. Much better is when you have laws where there's buy-in, and often you can get that buy-in if they start from an investigation that had both sides of the aisle invested in the fact-finding.
So for those who feel that there's been too little oversight of the Trump administration, what do you think then would be the smart areas Congress should focus on? Would it be wise, for instance, to stay away from anything that might duplicate Robert Mueller's investigation?
Well, I think the initial signs for oversight investigations have been very promising. The press keeps asking, well, are you going to do impeachment right up front? And the response has been, no, that's not what we're intending to do. And in fact, a lot of the Democratic committee chairs who are going to be chairing the committees in the new Congress have identified substantive areas they want to look at, protecting access to health insurance for people with pre-existing conditions, going after that drug price gouging, looking at cybersecurity, for example. There are Trump administration efforts to weaken bank regulation and environmental regulations, and committees say they want to look at those policy positions. So, you know, the effort to push Democrats into doing purely partisan, let's get the president, let's try to impeach him, have been rejected in favor of these substantive concerns. Now, we're going to have to see if that keeps working out. It could go a lot of different ways.
Right.
In terms of Mueller, I mean, many congressional investigations go on at the same time as criminal prosecutions, and they're done for policy purposes, not prosecutions. Congress cannot throw somebody in jail or fine them. What they can do is make policy changes. And while, you know, Mr. Mueller has already indicted 13 Russians who attacked our election systems, there are a lot of policy issues that still need attention, you know, strengthening our election systems, supporting research and implementation programs to detect and prevent intrusions, examining our whole cybersecurity defense programs. So there's a lot of area that Mueller is, you know, he's looking at the at prosecuting people, but Congress needs to look at those policy areas.
Let's hear from a caller, Rita in Manhattan. You're on WNYC.
Oh, hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. Yes, just on that point about Russia, I want to know if our Congress can investigate, I think it should be the Department of Homeland Security or another department, for not putting in place or not, you know, developing techniques and methods to protect us from Russia.
Elise Bean, is that something?
Yes, should.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. The failure to investigate, the failure to take to create protections for our electoral system is absolutely an area that people should look at. And that shouldn't be partisan. What it should be is none of us want our electoral systems to be affected by foreign governments, whether it's Russia, China, Iran, or anybody else. I would think that has bipartisan appeal across the board. We need those protections, and we need to find out what has been done and what should be done. The fact that we didn't see any sign of the same kinds of attacks on our electoral systems during the midterms gives me comfort that things were done. But we don't really know what those are or what should be done, what's still needed.
One of the things I really enjoyed about your book, Elise, is you really bring us into the nuts and bolts of being an investigator. You describe going into locked rooms, you know, for 8 hours and just reading documents and writing notes on a legal pad, or developing a strategy to put out your document requests to big corporations or federal agencies. And sometimes you flew around the world and met with regulators other places. How would you begin an investigation like the one we just talked about, looking at interference in the election? Where would you start?
Well, I mean, there's no secret sauce. People think there's some, you know, magic thing that you do when you're an investigator. Instead, it's just very hard work. You start off with a brainstorming session. How do we want to frame this issue? There's a lot to look at in the area of, you know, whatever you're looking at, you can approach it a lot of different ways. You come up with several approaches, and you check with your boss and see what appeals to your boss because you're working for somebody. Once you get direction, then you go back and you say, all right, what are all the ways that we can find out about this? You might start interviewing experts. Then you look at where can we get documents. And you have to be creative. There might be litigation that will help you find documents you couldn't find. There may be, you know, in Washington, there's an expert for everything. You need to find that expert and find out what documents they have.
And when
you interview people.
What kind of a timeline would you give yourself for that kind of work?
Well, the investigations that we did with Senator Levin took 1 to 2 years. That's just the reality. If you actually want to do it in a bipartisan way, your understanding of the facts needs to mature together. You need to agree on what documents to get, what interviews to do. You know, members of Congress, they see something in the paper, they want to have a hearing, you know, 2 days later. But when you do that, you really don't do much more than allow somebody who already knows about the issue to talk about it. If you actually want to investigate, that takes time. And it's hard for members of Congress to have the patience to give their staff the opportunity in a bipartisan way to find out what happened.
2 years in the life of a senator is only a third of their term, but since all attention is on the House now, 2 years is an entire term for a member of the House of Representatives. Let's hear from another caller, Bill in Westchester. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question for Elise Bean?
Well, it's kind of simple. I'm just wondering on his taxes, if the IRS already looked at it or they're reviewing it, don't they have the power to arrest him if he did something illegal?
Elise Bean, is President Trump's taxes, is that a matter that we can just leave to the IRS and trust that they will do something if there's something weird going on there?
Well, apparently Mr. Trump was subject to an audit pretty much every year. We don't know what happened with those audits, if adjustments were made. We've had new information come forth about what his father did and how he passed on assets to the children. There's also a question about whether a president could be indicted or have some sort of legal action taken against them while they're in office. Those are questions that have never really been resolved. Certainly after he gets out of office, the IRS could do something. Could they do something while he's in office? You know, again, Congress has a different role than the IRS. So the IRS tries to get the money that wasn't paid, identify problems. They can even take criminal action. That's not what Congress is supposed to do. Congress is supposed to look at his taxes in terms of policy. And, for example, are there real estate breaks for, tax breaks for real estate developers that are overly generous? Perhaps his tax returns would tell us something about that. You know, a person has a lot of money, making a lot of cash every year, and yet pays no taxes. If that is, in fact, the case, do we need to change the tax laws? That's the kind of job Congress has, as opposed to taking any sort of punitive action against the president himself.
Bill, thanks for your call. Elise Bean, former legal counsel to Senator Carl Levin, is my guest. She has a new book called Financial Exposure. It's really an investigator's memoir and a really great guide to learning all about how congressional investigations work. It's out now from Palgrave Macmillan. Number to call is 212-433-9692. And my name is Ilya Meritz, subbing for Brian Lehrer today. One of the things that is really striking to me reading your book, reading about the investigations that you did, particularly in money laundering, is that you hit powerful people where it hurt them. And one investigation resulted in Chilean strongman Augusto Pinochet being stripped of his immunity from prosecution in his own country. At one point in a different investigation, Benazir Bhutto, the Pakistani politician, actually showed up in your office unannounced because you were looking at her husband's bank accounts and she wanted you to knock off. What was that like?
Well, that was a big surprise. I was very early in my career, and we had been looking at what we really looked at was Citibank Private Bank that had opened up accounts for either foreign officials or their family members, and there were millions of dollars running through these accounts. With respect to Mr. Zardari, we had seen Citi had opened up accounts for shell companies that he secretly owned in their branches in Switzerland and Dubai, and we had seen over $40 million sort of fly through those accounts. We'd reached out to his lawyers to let them know what we'd found and to try to get his side of the story, but we didn't hear back from them. And then one day, Ms. Bhutto just showed up at our door. Luckily, my staff director, Linda Gastaitis, and I were both there. We invited her in. She sat down on our leather sofa.
Amazing.
And it was amazing. It was very casual. She had no one with her, and we laid out the evidence we had, the documents we had that indicated he owned these shell companies. We focused in on particular kinds of money that were highly suspect. She listened quietly. She didn't ask a lot of questions. At the end, she insisted that her husband had not been engaged in any wrongdoing and promised to send us evidence, but we never heard from her again.
And what happened with her husband and your investigation?
Well, so we had a hearing talking about him and several other people. The head of Citibank at the time, John Reed, was one of the witnesses. He testified that Mr. Zardari had a terrible reputation at the time and said the banker who opened accounts for him must have been, quote, an idiot. So that was pretty interesting. Citibank did close the accounts. Later, both Mr. Zardari and Ms. Bhutto were convicted in Pakistan of taking bribes, but both protested that those prosecutions were politically motivated. Mm-hmm. Our focus was not on whether they had engaged in wrongdoing. Our focus was on U.S. financial institutions that were moving millions of dollars in suspect money for foreign officials without asking virtually any questions. Now, I'll just say, as a result of that investigation, we were able to pass a law. At the time, U.S. banks could take money that was a product of foreign corruption as long as the corrupt acts took place outside the United States. We changed the law and we said, if you know money is a product of foreign corruption, you can't take it no matter where those acts took place.
And in fact, our laws on money laundering have become a lot stronger in the past dozen or so years. And yet, money laundering is kind of a hot topic in 2018. We had the Paul Manafort trial that basically showed how he moved tens of millions of dollars, illicit funds, out of Ukraine through Cyprus and St. Vincent into the United States. He purchased houses. He purchased an ostrich jacket. And then a short time later, when Michael Cohen entered his guilty plea, one part of the public information was that he had a hidden account to conceal income from the IRS from a loan that he had made off the books. And so I wonder, with all of this financial chicanery coming to light, do you think all those laws that got passed were somehow missing something? How is it possible that a Paul Manafort can bring so much money into the United States undetected?
Well, you're right that there's still a problems with money laundering. We certainly didn't cure all of the problems. Things are much better than they used to be. Banks are much more vigilant than they used to be. But one of the big problems in the world today are these shell companies with secret owners. The United States is the biggest offender in the world. We create nearly 2 million corporations a year, and we never ask, you know, who's behind any of them. So we create these things, and we have no idea. Other countries do it as well. In the case of Manafort, he had a whole variety of shell companies that opened up accounts in the United States, and the $75 million flowed into those accounts. And as you say, he didn't declare them on his taxes and was convicted after a jury trial.
And in fact, it only came to light because he put himself in the political spotlight, it seems.
Absolutely. I mean, part of the problem is the IRS has had its budget cut severely. They're 17% down. They have thousands of fewer agents. In fact, every dollar you give the IRS produces $4 to $7 in return when you go after tax cheats. But the Trump administration and the Congress, the Republican majority in Congress, have really concentrated on cutting back on the IRS, making it very hard for them to do investigations. And one of the problems is, as you say, people with tens of millions of secret dollars, suspect money coming to the United States, are not caught.
Let's hear from Robert in Queens. You're on WNYC.
Good morning. Thank you for taking me. I was telling your screener that the thing is that you hit the nail on the head talking about the corporations and how people can hide money. It's amazing. I mean, I found this out firsthand. You can hide millions of dollars in 50 different corporations, and it'll take the IRS years to go through it. That's how come we have the situation with Donald Trump. It's very easy to hide money. That's not the problem. The problem is that we need to change the system. If you change the system, we're going to have some backup. Right now, everything is geared for these people, these oligarchs and these people that are really high-end spenders. Everything. Even with Amazon coming in, we're giving billions of dollars in tax breaks to them, and they're corporations. Corporations make big money, and that's what this is all about, greed. And until we change the system, this ain't going to stop.
Elise Bean, Robert, thanks for your call. Do we have a system where Congress is perennially playing catch-up and the laws are just going to always be several years behind what people are actually getting up to?
Sure. That's always going to be a problem. But that doesn't mean you give up. I mean, there are still murders. That doesn't mean we give up, making murder illegal or get rid of the police. You have to continue. And there are a lot of honest taxpayers in the United States. In fact, most people pay their taxes, 80, 90% compliance paying their taxes. But that makes it even more important to go after those people who are cheating the system. And multinational corporations are among those that do that.
Yeah, and in fact, you spent a long time in the Senate investigating four big American corporations that are tax dodgers or were tax dodgers, Microsoft, Apple, Hewlett-Packard, and Caterpillar. What did you learn when you started to look into those companies' strategies to avoid paying taxes?
Well, I have to say that Senator Levin, who I worked for, sort of dragged us kicking and screaming into becoming international tax lawyers, because that's not an easy area. But I'll give you an example of one thing that we found. We looked at Apple. We found that Apple had exploited a quirk in law between the United States and Ireland. In the United States, we only tax corporations that are organized here. The rest are considered foreign corporations. But in Ireland, even if you incorporate within Ireland, if you're not managed and controlled from there, you're not taxed there. So what Apple did is they created three shell companies in Ireland with no employees and no physical presence, and therefore they were not taxable under Irish law. And then they said, well, they're not taxable under U.S. law either, since they were Irish corporations. And then Apple took the position that they were not taxable anywhere, sort of the holy grail of tax avoidance.
That's a pretty neat trick. Are they still able to do that?
Well, what happened is we traced $74 billion that had gone to those Irish subsidiaries, paying less than a 1% tax. Ireland sort of charged a yearly fee to allow Apple to have this arrangement. After our investigation, the EU looked into it more deeply, and they decided that this was that Ireland had provided illegal state aid to Apple by giving them this tax preferential treatment, and they hit them with a judgment for $14 billion. That $14 billion has been placed in escrow. Both Apple and Ireland are appealing the EU decision, so we don't know exactly what's going to happen. What Apple then did in response is they essentially closed down a lot of their tax shenanigans in Ireland, and they moved to Jersey, not New Jersey, the Isle of Jersey. And we don't really know what's going on there because there is a lot of secrecy attached to what multinational corporations do in terms of tax.
Seems like there's more work to be done there.
Well, one of the good things that happened, again, as a result in part from Center 11's investigation, is the OECD, an international body, got a bunch of countries to sign up to an agreement, including the United States, to require for the first time in 2018, very large multinational corporations are having to disclose to tax authorities on a country-by-country basis where they're doing business and where they're paying taxes and how much. That's never happened before. Those forms are being filed in 2018. An analysis of them has not started yet. But for the first time, we're going to have a little bit more transparency on corporate tax paying. But that transparency is only going to be for tax authorities. No policymaker or the public gets to see that information. And that's an ongoing battle to try to make those tax returns public, has basic information about where corporations do business, pay taxes, and how much. Still secret, but at least for the first time, that information is being collected on a systematic basis. And that's the power of oversight, that Congress can lead to those kinds of changes.
All right, we have time for one very quick call. Lawrence in Bayside, you're on WNYC.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
So if the Mueller investigation is theoretically limited to the Russian influence in the election, but is producing other intelligence, and Trump Inc. is producing intelligence, and New York State Attorney General is producing intelligence on Trump's Russian connections and laundering of Russian mafia money and his connection to Putin, can that be used by the House Judiciary Committee as the means and the motive to subpoena all that information and bring it together to bring an indictment against a sitting president?
Thanks for your call, Lawrence. Elise Bean, what do you say?
Well, Congress cannot use its investigations as sort of a way to then turn over information to prosecutors to indict. That's a separation of powers issues. So Congress can look at that different kinds of information from New York, from agencies, from Mueller, from elsewhere, for policy reasons. Are there weaknesses in the law that are allowing money laundering to happen? Are there conflicts of interest that we have to be wary of? Should we be tightening up, have a statute that implements the Emoluments Clause, for example, in the Constitution that prevents a sitting president from being engaged in business? There are a lot of policy issues that could be addressed by getting that information. And you really, when you make policy decisions, wouldn't it be nice to be informed to actually have the facts before you act? So there is a reason for Congress to get that type of information, but it would be for policy purposes, not to indict the president.
I feel like this is going to come as bad news for a lot of our listeners who want Congress to do investigations that are going to embarrass the president. But what you're saying is, if you want to be effective, make it bipartisan and make it about policy, not about people.
That's right. And not only is that the right way to proceed, it's also, the Supreme Court has said very clearly, that is the legal basis for Congress exercising its right to do oversight.
All right. My guest has been Elise Bean, a former top legislative aide to Michigan Senator Carl Levin. She's the author of a new book, Financial Exposure, all about doing congressional investigations. Elise, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.